Welcome to the Daily Briefing. So much to get into. Pot stocks are on a tear. The Consumer Price Index came out today. Fed Chair Powell made his remarks about the future of monetary policy and the economy. There's so much to talk about. And to make sense of that and more, we are joined by Real Vision editor Max Wheathy. Max, how are you doing?
Doing well, Jack. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be on the other side of the table, the virtual table today. Where do you want to start?
I think I want to start with an area that's close to your heart. Pot stocks, some marijuana stocks. I'm talking companies like Tilray, Canopy Growth, have been on an apps. They are riding the rocket ship. Particularly Tilray. And Max, I know you are an investor in this space. So what do you make of this price action other than the fact that I'm sure you're overjoyed?
Full disclosure, I do own a handful of cannabis stocks, and I have to say, Todd is God. So Todd Harrison, a Real Vision contributor, has been the guy who has really been, educating me on this. And as much as I'm going to try and steal some of his insight today, he is coming on Real Vision next week to talk about this, considering the massive run that we've seen since he came on with TG back in the end of 2020. And yeah, what you're seeing right now is really just an incredible run in these stocks, really across the board. But interestingly, it's the Canadian stocks that are running, which doesn't really make sense because the backdrop upon which much of this, price action is being attributed is the deregulation, or I guess, the regulation of the space here in the United States, and the fact that we're slowly opening. There appears to be bipartisan support for legalization here in the U.S., and you would think that U.S. stocks would be running. And Todd specifically highlights the MSOs, which are the multi-state operators. So in the U.S., obviously, we have 50 states, and there are different rules around cannabis in each state. And so there are certain operators that have exposure to more than just one state, and they're set to grow and to take advantage of this opening of the kimono. And well, he advises an ETF, MSOS, and you brought up a chart earlier that shows that MSOS since November 13 is only up 187%, whereas Tilray, I think, is up 813%.
Yeah, Max, actually, it's 87% versus 713. It's factored to 100, not percentage.
You know how I feel about that, Jack. You know how I feel about that. So 87%. Which incredible run considering, we're talking about a 3-month time span. But Tilray is absolutely running. And some of that has to do with Todd had a newsletter that came out today, and he sort of gave a couple of reasons for it. One is the greater fool, which is people who just don't know the difference. Two is that a lot of U.S. institutions can't really trade into the U.S. stocks yet. They're just not allowed to. And that this is just one option to play the trend. And so that's where the money is going. And three is sort of like, there will be some sort of cross-border effect, and the Canadian stocks may benefit from the same sorts of things that are happening on the U.S. side that the U.S. stocks will. But on its face, it doesn't really make too much sense. So that sector has been absolutely ripping, and personally, my take on it is it's part of the small cap reflation trade that has kind of played out. But at the same time, there is a longer term growth story there. So even if this trade sort of unwinds and we don't see, the Russell outperforming as we have recently, I still sort of believe in these stocks. And so, I'm building up cash positions rather than thinking I'm going to sell these if things go down. I'm building cash to sort of take advantage of the inevitable dips that will happen. Because when you have runs like this, there will be a pullback. It has to happen. That's what I'm paying attention to. And to sort of give some more clarity to why it doesn't really make sense, Todd, in his newsletter, he put out some work that a guy by the name of Sammy J did on Twitter, which if you look at the year for 2021, Canadian cannabis stocks are stocks that are all above 3 billion enterprise value, they're trading at 19 times enterprise value to revenue, whereas U.S. stocks are at 9.1 times. And then if you go enterprise value to EBITDA, U.S. stocks, 25 times, Canadian stocks 97 times. Go to 2022, you have US stocks at 6.8 times enterprise value to revenue, Canadian stocks at 13 times enterprise value to revenue. And same thing in EBITDA, you know, US stocks at 17 times, Canadian stocks at 53.6 times. So if the US really is the growth story, that's where it's all going to happen. You would think that that gap is going to close at some point. But then it gets back into Wall Street bets. You know, they have turned towards cannabis. So you can't deny that there is some meme factor going on. And look, it's a meme. The Canadian stocks were out there first. And so that's what people are talking about. They haven't learned fully about what's going on in the US. So, you know, when that gap is closed, I don't know, but I will be patient. Todd has said, you know, you gotta have the diamond hands. For these cannabis stocks. So,
yeah, I think paper hands get burnt, and the diamond hands are where it's at. Just to give color to what you said, just in this chart that we're going back to, the stock that is up the most by far is Tilray, which I think it's an American deposit receipt, but it is a Canadian company. And if I recall correctly, this was essentially the poster child of the of being a bubble stock during the cannabis bull market of 2017 and 2018.
My take, my play, the reason that, you know, I am invested in those MSOs is that, you know, those are the companies that are going to be operating in the US. If the story, the reason that the money is pouring into the sector is that, you know, the US is going to be open for business, then I want to be in the companies that are open for business in the US, the largest consumers in the world of this. And, you know, there is some incredible opportunity, I think, for investors like myself that I don't have the restrictions that institutions might have to get in front. It's the same sort of wall of money argument that is being made for Bitcoin, which I think is a great transition to what we, you know, have seen this week from Bitcoin. Obviously, you know, Elon Musk announced that Tesla had invested in Bitcoin. We saw a big run up and Bitcoin sold off a bit today. We're still at, I think, you know, who knows where we are at the time of filming, but at last I saw it was like up over 44,000. So not a major, you know, sell off by any means, but certainly it has affected some Bitcoin vehicles more than others. So, you know,
Max, you're really teeing me up here.
Yeah, plenty of different ways to play it. So you pointed out that MicroStrategy has had just like an incredible down day on news, or not news, but on the price action of Bitcoin. So talk to me a little bit about what you've seen over time with MicroStrategy as the ultimate Bitcoin trading sardine.
Well, I want to hear your metaphor, but sure. So I was just checking within the S&P, which were the stocks that were up the most and which were down the most, just to give me a sense of where the market was at. I decided to zoom out a little bit and check at the Vanguard All Market Index. So basically, essentially all equities. And the one that was down the second most, 19%, was MicroStrategies. And this is, you know, a technology company that notably was at the vanguard of putting Bitcoin on their corporate balance sheet. And as you can see, with MicroStrategy on this chart being in the blue and Bitcoin being in the red, MicroStrategy has paid off by investing in Bitcoin. But interestingly enough, you know, Bitcoin had a minor pullback today, but it was MicroStrategy that was down 19%. So I'm just looking at the volatility profile and looking at the daily change of MicroStrategy versus Bitcoin. And, you know, again, Bitcoin is in red and MicroStrategy is in blue. It being down 19.7% today. But if I didn't know which, it would be hard to tell which one's Bitcoin and which one's MicroStrategy. They're both so volatile.
Yeah, but you can also see that blue spike going up at times when going up above the red spike. So it is going both ways, which is why I said, you know, it might be the ultimate Bitcoin trading sardine, which is just something that somebody said to me, you know, these sardines are for trading, not for eating. And yeah, I talked to Warren Irwin last week on Real Vision Live, and we were talking about the uranium cycle, and he was saying, look, there are about 20 uranium companies. Like if and when uranium really starts to run, like that number is going to explode and you can make good money in those other companies. But he's like, I wouldn't own any of them. They're great for trading. And he I'm talking from his perspective. He will own them and will participate in some ways, but he's not going to, you know, own them in the same way he might a mine that he actually believes in the fundamentals and understands. And so, you know, the same thing can be said for companies that are exposing themselves to Bitcoin. That doesn't mean, you can get exposure in lots of different ways, but, you know, make sure you have the right time scale.
Absolutely. So marijuana, Bitcoin, MicroStrategy, we've covered a few of these more niche topics, but let's cover the bread and butter issue of the day, which is Fed Chair Jay Powell's speech today. What did you make of his remarks, and what do you think that means for the economy going forward?
Well, it was pretty much, you know, like holding the course. There wasn't too much that came out. It's hard to believe. You know, when I first started at Real Vision, like Fed Day was like a big event, and I would have, you know, options positions in TLT, things like that, and we would get very excited about Fed Day. And now, like, I have to be reminded that you know, Powell is giving a speech and whatnot. So, you know, they have been pretty open about, you know, what they want, and, you know, they haven't really gotten the inflation that they say that they're targeting. You know, 2% is fine, a little bit over 2% is fine. We're not quite there. We also got what, CPI number today, which came out at what 1.4, something like that.
Yes, that was the year over year number, which was slightly below expectations, and then the month over month was 0.3, which was exactly at expectations. So that kind of moves on to our next topic, which is inflation and specifically reflation. Over the past 6 months, Max, you know, you and I have heard many market participants say that inflation is just around the corner, but it hasn't really appeared yet. But the assets that do well in an inflationary and reflationary environment, they certainly have been bid up. I'm talking about, you know, the banks, copper, industrials, energy companies. So, you know, there's a chart. If you look, the U.S. 10-year yield and copper, and then the KBW Bank Index, they have essentially traded in lockstep since August. So we have had this reflationary move, this positioning that's expecting inflation and growth, but we haven't seen it so much in the data. What do you make of that, Max?
Well, I mean, copper makes sense to me. I actually have a question about why you included the banks on that. To me, it's about like yield curve steepness, and you need some level of yields to be high for the banks to take advantage of the steepness of yield curve. So why did you put the banks on there as an inflation play?
Well, I put it on there with a yield curve play and a growth play. So that actually, you know, if we look at a chart of the yield curve today, it is upwardly sloping, suggesting that it's a positive environment for banks. Banks like steep yield curves, and they like high rates. But that actually, your question is a good one. It makes me think of Ed's interview with Lynn Alden, which airs tomorrow, where Lynn made the case that if yields go up, that is bank heaven, essentially, for the reasons that I just mentioned, because they borrow short and they lend long. But if inflation roars hot and then the bond market sells off, forcing the Fed to enact yield curve control, then you have inflation with low yields. So basically, real yields are, you know, that sinks real yields to the bottom of the ocean floor, and that is really good for gold. So I think the gold, banks, and then industrial metals, those sort of all play within each other, and there are certain nuances into which is good with which, but they all hinge around reflation and yield. So that's why I put those charts together. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, no, that answers my question. It was a bit of a leading question. But yeah, you know, you were talking about Lynn's interview. I just went through Julian Brigden's interview that's going to come out next Monday, and he's, you know, one of the other people who's talking about inflation being just around the corner. I mean, at this point, we've gone around the block a few times with how many corners we've had to look around. But he makes the same thing. And one of the things that he talks about, which I think is really important, is the reactive nature of policy. Like, it's just they are reactive to the market. They are responsive to it. And so, you know, that scenario you're talking about where yields kind of accelerate, you know, to the upside, you know, that could cause some problems. And that's probably when we would see the Fed step in, but it wouldn't be before that. They're not going to like proactively announce yield curve control unless something really breaks in the market. So, you know, the scenario that's really the scenario he's looking out for, but he kind of said, you know, should it just kind of slowly creep up, that would be, you know, a sign for him to just, you know, add that risk to these sorts of reflation bets that he's really bullish on. So, you know, watching the same sorts of things.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Nice. Max, while we're in plugging mode, I might just mention that Howard Marks' peer-to-peer conversation with Joel Greenblatt airs on Friday, and they address some of the exact same things. And it's interesting because I typically think of those, you know, legendary investors who are very attuned, very in the weeds on their asset class. But in this, they zoomed out and talked about more macro issues. So, you know, Joel and Howard talked about how the U.S. government and Treasury should take advantage of these record low rates and issue 50-year and 100-year paper. And I think Howard said, if Argentina can issue an 100-year bond, why can't the U.S.? And that actually reminded me. I was reading this the other day. It was a sort of a treatise on corporate bond yields in the early 19th century. And I'll just position this to you, Max. In 1900 to 1910, guess what percentage of corporate bonds had a duration over 30 years?
Not that many. I just did an interview where like the 30-year mortgage didn't exist back then. So I highly doubt corporate bonds were much longer than, what, 5 years?
You could not be more wrong, Max. Over 50% of all bonds in 1900s had a duration over 30 years. And that really surprised me. So I agree. I think Howard Marks makes a good point. If in 1900, railroads that may not exist in a few years could issue extremely long duration bonds, then certainly the US government can issue a 50 or even 100 year bond. So that's just where I'm thinking. And that comes out on Friday. So today we had Russell Napier, Steve Clapham. Tomorrow it's Lynn Alden. On Friday, Joel Greenblatt, Howard Marks. And then on Monday is your interview with Julian.
Yeah, I'm cut out of that. So don't expect to have to fast forward through my parts, everybody.
Well, Max, let's move on to another topic, which is it's a very hot topic that has really seized the zeitgeist. And we haven't talked about it on Real Vision as much as we should. And that is SPACs, or a special purpose acquisition company. And you know, these have become incredibly prolific as they offer companies, more nascent companies, growth-oriented companies, a chance to go public without the IPO process where you have to have all of these filings. And so far, it's worked out wonderful for investors and for the companies themselves. But there's a little bit of stuff behind the curtain that I want to get into. Max, what's your outlook on SPACs right now?
My outlook is borrowed from people much smarter than myself, but it's basically that it's not going to stop. And partially it's because of the returns that you would see on this chart that you shared with me today. It's because it is working for all of the parties involved. And until people get burnt, it's gonna just keep on happening. So I think it's a trend that will continue. And the structure is very beneficial to both the sponsors and the companies. It allows them to generate a tremendous amount of raise a tremendous amount of cash. And so, you know, I think it will continue. That doesn't mean that there won't be good companies in it, but, you know, anytime there seems to be like free money lying on the ground, you know, anybody who's smart enough is going to take advantage of that. And, you know, bad actors can be just as smart as good actors. So I think, you know, keep your wits about you, but this is a runaway train that's going to keep on rolling.
Yes. And we don't know when the train will go off the tracks, but people are having a lot of fun on the train now. Just to go back to that chart. So from January 1st, 2019 to January 22nd, 2021, SPAC investors have had an average gross return of 90%, which is, so the SPAC investors are basically the retail people who buy it once it goes public. So 90%, that sounds good. But then you realize that the SPAC sponsors have an average return of 958%, which is off the charts. That is, in other words, it is extremely lucrative for investors and sophisticated hedge funds and investment vehicles to sponsor SPACs and help bring these companies to market. So the incentives are all there for the very, very wealthy.
Yeah. And interestingly, one of the things on there is I see the post-merger buy and hold investor returns versus the IPO index. So the average person who buys a SPAC versus buys an IPO actually underperforms an IPO. So it's great for the companies. It's great for the sponsors. But compared to for the retail investor who is choosing between, you know, they want to get access to new companies, new trends. If you're choosing between a company that, you know, maybe did it the hard way and went and IPO'd or a company that did it with a SPAC, you're actually underperforming that IPO index.
Yes, definitely. And especially when you look at the post-merger buy and hold investor gross returns, yeah, that is 44%. So let's, Max, is there anything else on your mind? I have a few final charts I want to get out of the way, but is there anything else on the macro landscape?
No, I mean, really just that thing that I was talking about with, you know, the pot stocks. It sounds so weird to say that. I feel like pot is like what, you know, your mom calls it when she's yelling at you. You know, is that pot I smell? But it's that, you know, these companies are benefiting from trends that are going on right now, from like the hot market. They're benefiting from that. But there's a good story, a good, you know, growth narrative that looks out further than just this current, you know, mania that's happening. And so those are the types of sectors, the types of companies that personally I'm looking at right now, which are, you know, there is a great story right now, but looking out, like I actually really believe in them. So if all the stuff that we're talking about with the markets being frothy, with the questions people have about it being a bubble, you know, I'm not worried that some of these companies are going to be the leaders on the other side. Like I do truly believe that. So that's the type of company I'm looking at in this type of environment, the type of sector I'm looking at. And, you know, Take it with a grain of salt. It's what I'm looking at, and maybe that's not enough for everybody else. But you know, that's personally what I think is the type of thing. If you like me are looking around and saying, you know, this is it's getting a little hot, getting a little frothy. Who knows how long it could go on? You know, I'm going to ride it. I'm gonna participate, but I'm gonna do it with things that, you know, I actually believe in.
Wise words, Max.
All right, Jack. So it seemed to me like you were leading, that you have something else you want to talk about. So let's hear it.
All right. Well, GameStop essentially has descended from its heights of the last week. But if you look at the options activity, there still are some believers out there who have bought extremely out of the money options. Options that expire this Friday and then next Friday at the 800 strike price. So you know I think that a lot of GameStop investors are they're out of the money, but they're not out of the game yet. So I wouldn't declare this a dead narrative and just throw this story in the trash. Okay, people in the, you know, we in the financial media, we got some good headlines out of this, and now we can move on to the next story. I think this could recur. And we could be hearing about it again. And then if you look at the short interest as a percentage of the floats, it still remains as 50%, which is an extremely high number, down admittedly from the 140%. The folks on Wall Street Bets, for a while, they were saying that this data, which I'm quoting, which comes from a firm called S3, was faulty, and that that's not the real data, that they've conspired with the hedge funds in order to make it look like the shorts covered their position. Whereas now, when I go on Wall Street Bets, I see very little about GME, which made me a little sad. But yeah, I just wanted to share those two data points. Max, I know you have somewhat of a very different opinion on this whole GameStop affair.
Yeah, and I'll keep that to myself for now. But you know what we were talking about things being good trading vehicles. I just pulled up the one-day chart, the intraday chart, and the difference in price between 9:45 and 1:30 was 30%. And then if you take it from that same peak at 1:30 and take it all the way down, it's down 17% from that high as of where it closed, and now it's down another 2.93% after hours from what I'm looking at right now. So, if you're a trader, if you're looking for volatility, if that's what gets you excited, there's still plenty of action in GameStop.
Yes, definitely. I think a serious catalyst in the price going down was, of course, Robinhood and these other retail brokerages stopping trading or stopping the buying of securities. That is completely stopped for now. You look at the time series of the volume weighted at price. You used to see all these little interstices indicating that no one could buy, no one could sell. But now it's essentially a fully functioning free market. So I think that if there are players who want to reload their guns and drive this up again, they've got tons of runway in front of them. Max, great to have you on the Daily Briefing. Talk to you soon.